What is the meaning of personhood? Find out today on Principles and Policies. Hello, I'm your host today, Chuck Michaelis, the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principal Policy and the Executive Director of Camp American. That question, what is the definition of personhood, is making a big splash these days. Right now in Ohio, there is a movement. You may have been asked to sign a petition, and if you haven't been asked to sign a petition, please let us know, and we will hook you up with someone that will be glad to take your signature on a petition that would go to creating an amendment to the Ohio Constitution, a much needed amendment to the Ohio Constitution, I'm afraid, although it shouldn't be necessary, that would declare that human beings are persons from the moment of fertilization. And that is where the big controversy comes in, because there are people on the pro-abortion side of the fence who don't want you to think that way. They want to deny that an embryo is a person. They want to artificially define personhood on the basis of perhaps more radicals as birth. The ultra-radicals actually don't want you to think of your born infant as a person until some weeks and sometimes months after birth, as proposed by a quote-unquote bioethicist by the name of Peter Singer. And we we won't go into that because reasoning is so absurd. It has to do with being sentient and being self-aware. Well, that's nonsense. If you've ever had a child, I have three daughters, you'll know that that being is very self-aware about a moment after birth when they suddenly realize they're no longer in that nice warm water, cushiony water floating around, but now they're out here in the light and out here in the cold and out here with a bunch of people standing around that they have never encountered before, and they're very uncomfortable, and they let you know by squalling their eyes out and screaming at the top of their lungs, which makes parents, if you've ever been involved in the birth process, makes parents very happy because it means they have a happy, healthy, and very angry child who is letting the world know that they are alive and have been alive since the moment of conception. And that is exactly the point, ladies and gentlemen. This self-awareness, every time that child is hungry, they're aware of it, and they let you know. So, do they look in a mirror and say, hey, that's me? No, they don't. But they're certainly aware that they're hungry, and they're certainly not afraid to let you know about it. And they're not afraid to let you know if you're using the old-style diapers. I can remember once when I was a kid, I was very little, but I have a very firm memory of my mom accidentally sticking, just not very hard, just barely pricking my little brother while she was changing his diaper with a pin. And boy, let me tell you, he was self-aware at that point. And that's kind of the whole point of what we're going through today. Today's presentation is from Dr. Charles Rice, and actually that was a very popular presentation. We did the first part of this presentation. This was a two-hour presentation, two classes in a row, done by Dr. Charles Rice, who is a professor emeritus of law at Notre Dame Law School. And Dr. Rice is, if you've never heard of him, you just do a Google search, you will find that Dr. Rice is a very famous name in pro-life circles. Dr. Rice has written extensively on the beginnings, the origins of life. When I say the origins, I'm talking about when life begins. Dr. Rice has written extensively on the ethics of abortion, or lack thereof. Dr. Rice is a strong voice in the pro-life community, and he can be a very intimidating teacher. As those of you who listened to the first presentation in this series, Dr. Rice teaches kids and adults and his law students, he doesn't pull any punches. He uses what they call a Socratic method, where he asks questions, and he asks very pointed questions, and he demands answers. Now, some people say it sounds mean. It's not mean. It's teaching people how to think fast on their feet. And that's exactly the entire point of this presentation, is getting to learn to think fast on your feet and to be able to answer these questions, because believe me, if you're in a presentation, if you're in a discussion with someone who is pro-abortion, you're going to get the cliched questions all the time. This is learning how to deal with those questions and dealing with them on a very fast basis. Dr. Rice today is giving this presentation on what the meaning of personhood is. And he will walk through a logical process, and he will use this Socratic method, and he will use the question and answer technique. Like I say, it can be a little intimidating, but believe me, it's well worth sitting through and learning how to answer the questions and seeing the techniques that he uses and the logic that he uses. The logic is simply unassailable. So that being said, I am going to take it away to Dr. Rice, and I will give a finishing presentation when he is through for just a few minutes. This is the next to last of the Camp American series that we're going to do. Camp American starts Sunday, and if you want to find out more about that, you still have time to sign up. Believe it or not, you can still make plans because it starts tomorrow at 6 o'clock in the evening. Tomorrow, June 24th at 6 o'clock in the evening, and we will take your registration right up until, oh gosh, probably today. And if you want to find out about that, you can call me at 614-893-5986. That's 614-893-5986, or go to www.campamerican.com. That's www.campamerican.com.
Okay, this is apparently what's the title, Pro-Life Day, or what? How long do we have? Okay. Do you ever hear of Louise Brown? Do you ever hear of her? Who is she? Nobody ever heard of her? All right. Louise Brown is the first human being ever put together by in vitro fertilization. What is that? Ever hear? All right, what is it? Yeah. They put them together on a test tube, right? Right. She was the first so-called test tube baby. And she was born 9 months later in 1978. She is now 31 years old. And the point is that the whole world knew exactly when her life began. There's no question about it. Her life began on the dish, right? Was she a human being at that point? Huh? Yeah. What happened? I mean, you were all former zygotes, you know that? Yeah, what's a zygote? Did you ever hear it? Anybody ever hear that? All right? You're also former embryos. Did you ever hear that term? Yeah? Okay. The zygote is the one cell human being which exists upon the fertilization of the egg by the sperm. One cell. Then it divides. And when it becomes two cells, it becomes an embryo. The term embryo just means that developing human being up until 8 weeks. Then at 8 weeks, they call that developing human being a fetus, F-E-T-U-S. What does that word mean? Anybody know? All right, all it means is young one. Right? These are just designations. But your life, begins. There's no question when your life begins. And the question that we're dealing with in terms of the pro-life stuff is legal. It's also moral. You ever heard of Roe versus Wade? What's that? They decided what? Yeah, but why? All right, you've gone into the Constitution, right? Why do you have constitutional rights? Yeah, okay, fine. But in terms of the Constitution, 14th Amendment, 5th Amendment, which protect both of them protect the right to life. Who has the right to life? What do you have to be to have the right to life under the Constitution? No, not human. Alive? No, Stitch is alive. Yeah. Yeah, right. No. To have the right to life? What are you kidding? You don't have a right unless you're an American citizen? You mean you can put all the aliens up against the wall and terminate them? No way. No way. Hey, you know what you're thinking of? You're thinking of the language of the 14th Amendment, which says that all persons born or naturalized in the United States are citizens thereof and of the state wherein they reside. And the 14th Amendment says the state may not deny to any citizen the privileges or immunities of citizenship. So you're on the right direction, but you're half off the track, right? The question is, what do you have to be to have the constitutional right to life? Huh? Now, the 14th Amendment says no state shall deprive any person of life without due process of law, nor deny to any person the equal protection of the laws. Okay. What's a person, smart guy? Are you a person under the Constitution? Huh? Is Stitch a person? Huh? What do you have to be? Is every human being a person? The runover one. But is every human being entitled to be a person? What did the Supreme Court say in Roe versus Wade? Well, let me tell you about it. Let me give you a little lecture in law, okay? Just a little bit. The question was whether the Texas law and the Georgia law were constitutional because they restricted abortion. Yeah. Yeah, any time you have questions, just raise your hand. Yeah, you're right. Keep going. You want the mic? Keep going. No. Hey, fine. Keep going. All right. Okay. All right. All right. Okay. All right. In the Texas law said there's no abortion except to save the life of the mother. And that's there is no case today where that is necessary. The Georgia law says there's no abortion except to save the life of the mother and also for rape and incest, where the child is conceived by rape or incest. And the question was, can the state restrict abortion? So the Supreme Court decided, the first thing they decided was that we don't know, this is where you're on the right track, we don't know whether this is a human being this what they call the fetus. It's crazy. They describe the unborn child as the fetus, but then kept talking about the mother. How are you going to be a mother if you're not talking about a human being? But they said, we don't decide whether this is a human being. What we do decide is that under the 14th Amendment and implicitly under the 5th Amendment, you're not a person until birth. All right? So that before birth, you have no constitutional rights at all. And they said, well, we don't have to decide whether this is a human being, but he's not a person. And that's the same as a decision that an acknowledged human being is not a person. They said, in effect, whether or not this is a human being, he's not a person. All right? You ever hear of Dred Scott? Who's Dred? Who did he play for? Who's Dred Scott? Huh? All right, the Dred Scott case was in 1857. I remember it well. In 1857, the Supreme Court said that the free descendants of slaves could not be citizens. That was what they held. And they said that slaves were property rather than persons. All right? And Roe versus Wade is exactly the same principle. And it's the same principle as the Nuremberg Laws. The Nuremberg Laws in Germany in 1935 depersonalized Jews. In effect, they said Jews are entitled to no legal rights under German law, period. So it's the same thing. You depersonalize a human being, right? And the court said that the unborn child is not a person until birth. So you have a lot of questions that come up, and they had this. Business, the partial birth abortion situation, you're not even a person until your delivery is completed. All right, so that's the basic premise of it. And if you're going to, I don't want to get into the clinical details, but if you're going to talk about legal abortion, make sure you put it in terms of that. Make sure you say, hey, wait a minute, pal. You have your rights under the Constitution if you're a person. Don't you think all human beings should be persons? That's the issue. Because the case for legalized abortion is that we can define some human beings as non-persons. And that's exactly the principle that was the Nazi principle with respect to the Jews, and also the principle of Dred Scott with respect to the slaves. So that's the question you got to ask, right? And your reasons given for legalized abortion, you know, for example, the life of the mother. Okay? Who have we not bothered yet? Okay, the red sweatshirt. All right? You're on a life raft, all right? Who are you? Huh? Wesley? And who are you? Cora? Yeah, the boat sank, you're floating around on a life raft. You and Wesley, all right? But the thing is sinking. You can hold one of you. Can either one of you push the other one overboard? Do you have a moral right to do that? Huh? Let me tell you about a couple of cases. Now, think about this. Think about the question, the law, even before Roe versus Wade, said you can have an abortion where it's necessary to save the life of the mother. Don't buy that one either. Let me tell you about a couple of cases. They had Regina against Dudley and Stephen, where it was a British case back in the 19th century, where they had a ship that went down and the crewmen were floating around on the lifeboat and they were starving. And they're going to die from hunger. So they looked at the cabin boy and they said, "Guess what's for dinner?" And they killed the cabin boy and ate him. All right? Should they have been convicted of murder? Did they have a right to do that? Should they have been convicted of murder? They were prosecuted for murder. And it was, if they hadn't killed him and eaten him, they all would have starved to death. Huh? Right? They have a legal right to kill him? Not even to save their own lives? Yeah, you know why? The court said that. The court said, no, you can't do that because he was not an aggressor. Right? Who are you? Yeah. Huh? Tyler comes at you with a knife, all right? And the only way, he comes at you with a knife, he's trying to kill you. The only way you can save your life is he got you down on the deck and you got your 45, and the only way you can save your life is to ventilate Tyler between the eyes. Can you do it? Do you intend to kill him? No. 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 All right. Saving the life of the mother. Listen, you have a right to defend yourself. But in moral terms, you have that right under what's called the principle of the double effect, that your intent is not to kill Tyler, but to stop him. And if Tyler comes at you and you finally, and when Tyler's coming at you with a knife, and you say, "Wow, great, I finally got my chance to rid the world of Tyler." All right? And you intend to kill him. That's immoral. You have the right. No private person ever has the right intentionally to kill anybody. Self-defense is not an exception, because self-defense, properly speaking, the law doesn't get into this, but properly speaking, self-defense is not intentional killing. So when we're talking about abortion to save the life of the mother, you're talking about Regina against Dudley and Stephen, where they said, "Hey, that cabin boy was not an aggressor. He was not attacking you. His name was not Tyler. All right? And you had no right to kill him because it wasn't self-defense." The other case was United States against Holmes, where they had a ship that went down, and the crewmen were on a big lifeboat with passengers, and there were too many people on that boat, and it was taking out water and it was sinking. So the crewmen invited the passengers to go for a swim. They threw them overboard. All right? They were prosecuted for murder. Should they have been convicted? Sure, same principle. Passengers were not aggressors. And when you talk about abortion to save the life of the mother, you remember, you're not talking about an aggressor. That kid is just sitting there, minding his own business. And you never have the right to kill somebody, except in the case of self-defense. Or if you're the state. Now, hey, you listen. The state does derive its authority from God. They have the right, in two cases, to take life. That's capital punishment and the just war. But they never have the right, even in a just war, intentionally to kill the innocent. Ever. Never. Yeah. If you're pregnant, you already have a child. Yeah, well, look, you never, ever have the right intentionally to kill another human being. And life is precious. I was out, you've heard about that Notre Dame fiasco, right? Where they gave the honorary degree to President Obama. So that was a total disgrace. I was out at there were two graduations that day. You had the regular graduation with Obama, and they just fawned all over this guy. And then you had the student group. The students organized this. The students had, it was called ND Response. They had a graduation was like a spiritual retreat. You know, they had Eucharistic adoration all night, and then they had Mass, and they had at the grotto, they had the rosary and all the rest of this stuff, and they had 3,000 people there. And this is part of this whole package in terms of the whole abortion thing. The reason I mention it is because one of the people who spoke at the student graduation, the pro-life graduation, was a Notre Dame grad, 1989. He's a priest, Father Raphael, from New Orleans. And he's in ministry to youth and all that. And he said that he had a changed experience, experience that changed his outlook a few years ago. He said, I had he was in a college, he knew this girl, and the girl came in and she told him, look, I'm pregnant. And he was talking with her, and he said, what struck me was that she said, you know what's the hardest part about this? Is I tell people, you know, family or close friends, to say, you know, I'm pregnant. I'm not married, I'm pregnant. She said their reaction is, oh, that's too bad. And she said, I know it's not the way it should be. But I don't think it's bad that I have this life growing in me. He said that changed his whole attitude. Life is a gift from God. Totally. And it's never ours to take innocent life. I mean, we have to use our reproductive capacity pursuant to the commandments and God's law. We have no right to go out and commit fornication or adultery or any of that stuff. but we never have a right to kill. Yeah. Good question. What about the case where both the mother and the child are in danger? Suppose they both would die. That used to be a significant medical problem. It really did. I'm talking about 100 years ago, 60 years ago, where you'd have this question, and you'd say, well, what can we do? The question is, can you terminate the life of the child in order to save the life of the mother? And the answer is no. You've got to use your best efforts to save both. I mean, it's the same thing as the people on the life raft. I mean, you haven't got the right to do that. Today, that's not a problem. Today, that does not happen. But you got to deal with the theoretical question. Suppose that were the case. In the 100 years ago, before they had the medical techniques we have, more than that, 120 years ago, they would do a craniotomy sometimes. They would go in and kill the baby, take the baby out, because they thought that would save the life of the mother. And you can't do it. Morally, you can't do it. Why? Because that baby is not an aggressor. And you don't have the right to take that life, even to save your own life. You don't have the right to do that. If there are two people on the one person raft, neither one of them has the right to throw the other one overboard. They're just in a tough situation. Yeah. That's correct. Right. That's correct. But even if you could say, as far as we can tell by sound medical judgment, yes, unless we kill the baby, the mother's going to die, you can't do it. Now, let me give you the exception. It's not really an exception. Suppose you have the mother who is pregnant and has a cancerous womb. She has cancer of the uterus, all right? And little Nemo is swimming around inside there, okay? But she has a cancerous womb. If she were not pregnant, they'd take it right out to save her life, all right? But she's pregnant. And if they take the womb out in order to save her life, Nemo dies. All right? I say Nemo because it's just a generic Latin term meaning no one. Well, he's not no one. He's a little guy in the womb, all right? So can you do that? Can you do that? And the answer is yes. Why? Because of the double effect. One action has two effects. Taking out the womb has the good effect, which is justified, of saving the mother's life. If you don't take that womb out now, and you can't postpone the operation until Nemo is viable, if you don't take that womb out now, she dies, and you know she's going to die. But it has the effect of killing Nemo. But the key is the intent. You don't intend to do that. Same thing if the baby is growing in the fallopian tube. You can remove the damaged portion of the tube even though you know it's going to kill the developing human being. So that's the double effect is important there. But you can never, ever intentionally kill a non-aggressing human being. As a private person, you can never do that. And it stands to reason that if that's the case, all the more so, rape and incest do not justify abortion. but you don't have the right to kill the baby because of the identity of his father. And all incest cases are rape cases unless they're both adults, consenting adults. If you've got an underage person, that's a rape case. So there's no justification. Health of the mother. If you can't kill the baby for the mother's life, you can't kill the baby for the mother's health or because she wants to go to graduate school. And you can't kill the baby for the defect of the child because that's what the Germans did. By the way, you know, in the past several years, you don't see many Down syndrome kids around because it has become fairly routine medical practice to abort, to do the prenatal testing and to abort Down syndrome children. A Down syndrome kid can have a defect ranging from very, very minor to very, very major. The families who have children with Down syndrome will tell you it's the greatest blessing they ever had. But our culture is really in a bad way. In legal terms, the abortion thing is getting beyond the law because the abortions of the not only of the future but increasingly of the present are early abortions by chemicals, IUDs. Most of the so-called contraceptives operate alternatively as abortifacients because they prevent implantation. The Food and Drug Administration has accepted a court order which lowered the age at which a person can buy the morning after pill, Plan B, without a prescription. What Plan B does, it operates in three ways. One way is to prevent ovulation, prevent the woman from, you know, putting out the egg. That's a contraceptive effect. Another way is to prevent the sperm from joining the egg. That's also a contraceptive effect. And the third way is by irritating the lining of the womb so that the new human being cannot implant in the womb. When you are conceived, when you first came into business, 5 to 7 days later, you implanted in your mother's womb. And life begins at fertilization. But the law increasingly is defining pregnancy as beginning at implantation. And so these abortifacient drugs and the morning after pill are just being sold without prescription, sold as contraceptives, and they are actually abortifacients. So it's an interesting thing. The whole contraceptive mentality is the mentality that I'm in charge, I'm in control, and I will decide whether and when life will begin. And that's very closely connected to the abortion mentality as a failsafe. So abortion is moving beyond the law. This is and that's actually good, you know, that because that's now it's moving on to our turf. It's moving on to the moral and the religious. The law is not going to be able to handle this. Same thing with euthanasia. You ever hear of Terri Schiavo? Yeah, who is she? Nah, why do you mean human vegetable? What are you talking about? Right? Okay. She was in a, they said she was in a PVS, persistent vegetative state. I'm not trying to give you a hard time. I am trying to give you a hard time. It's fun. Yeah, you're a good straight man. It's good. Wait a minute. All right. Now listen. How much time do we have left? 5 minutes? Oh, okay. Let's talk about this. You guys are living in a culture of death, all right? You're living in a culture where the intentional killing of innocent human beings is increasingly regarded as a problem-solving technique. That's what Columbine was all about. That's what these random shootings are all about. You don't like your classmates? Blow them away. And abortion is the clearest example of this. But in Shaivo, you had the question of what do you do in terms of the patient who is in need of care or in need of feeding. And the principles are pretty clear. The law, until recently, and the moral principles coincided in the sense that you're obliged to use all ordinary means of medical treatment to preserve your life. You're not obliged to do everything you can possibly do, because death is not the end of existence as far as we're concerned. But you got to use ordinary means. And what are ordinary means? Depend on the situation. If you can add 6 months to your life by having both legs amputated, you have to do it now. Right? But there are questions there. But when we're talking about food and water is not a medical act, the provision of food and water. It's like sanitation. And the law now has gotten to the point where in the Elizabeth Bouvier case back in the 1980s in California, you had a woman who was competent. She was in a hospital. She said, "Hey, I want to die, but I want you to, and I'm not going to eat. I'm going to refuse to eat because I want to die. But I want to stay here and die. I don't want to die out in the park someplace. And I want you to take care of me while I die." And it went to court, and she won. And the court established the principle that a competent adult can refuse to eat. She could eat by mouth. She just didn't want to do it. She later changed her mind, by the way. As far as I know, she's still alive. But that's the principle. And if you're incompetent, what does that mean, incompetent? It means you can't make your own decisions. The law says that, generally speaking, the law says that if you have an incompetent patient, the person who is in charge can withdraw food and water, including food and water by feeding tube, if the patient would have wanted it, if the patient would have wanted not to be kept alive by food and water, or in a lot of states, if it's in the best interest of the patient to die. Now, when you say, you understand what's happening here, that the law has implicitly legalized suicide in the sense that it used to be if somebody went on a hunger strike and said, "I'm going to die, I'm not going to eat," you'd feed him. But the question in the Shaivo case involved Terry Schiavo, who Judge Greer went through this thing for years. And the question was, is she in a persistent vegetative state? They said she was. So what does that mean? A persistent vegetative state is just awake unconsciousness. The patient is awake, but doesn't respond. A coma is asleep unconsciousness, right? So a PVS patient, and it's a dubious, you know, it's a question of judgment call as to whether a patient is still a living human being. But Judge Greer had Terry Schiavo's family on the one hand and her husband, Michael. And Michael wanted Terry to die. And Michael wanted to remove her feeding tube. The family said she could eat anyway by mouth, but that was a disputed question. But she was on a feeding tube. She was in no pain. She was not dying. And the question was Michael's petition. He said, I want to remove the tube. There was money floating around there, and he wanted to marry his girlfriend, Jody Sintanzi, with whom he already had two kids. And he wanted to remove the tube. Well, Judge Greer handed down three orders. I'm going to tell you what they said, and I want you to pay attention. The first order said, Michael is authorized to remove the feeding tube. Now, that's what we do in abortion cases. The law authorizes the mother to kill her child. Law doesn't make her kill the child. The second order, later on, authorized Michael to remove not the feeding tube, but nutrition and hydration, food and water. Now listen to this. The third order said this. Said, Michael shall remove. It ordered him. He shall remove nutrition and hydration from the ward, that is Teresa Schiavo, at 1 o'clock on March 18th, 2005. He shall remove not the feeding tube, but nutrition and hydration. That was crossing the line. Because in that case, they ordered the execution of Terry. They didn't just authorize him to do that. They ordered it. It's as much a scheduled execution as the ones they did down the road at Rayford Prison in Florida. Now, why is that important? I'll tell you why it's important. It's important because you heard of that case only because the family disagreed. This is something you got to think about. You got to think about this in terms of the morality involved. What happened in the Schiavo case happens all the time, and you never hear about it because the family and the caregivers agree. Because the law allows withdrawal of food and water whenever the family and the caregivers, the doctors, agree that the patient would want it, or in some states, that it would be in the patient's best interest. And when you take out food and water with the intent not to put it back, that's homicide. So that's the situation there. And what it is this general thing I was telling you about, which is that you're in a culture where the intentional infliction of death is a legitimate problem-solving technique. And you got to resist that. Yeah.
You,
That could be, as far as the medical treatment is concerned, that could be extraordinary, and therefore not required. As far as the food is concerned, that's not even medical treatment. And the problem is the law today puts them both in the same category. See, we had Karen Quinlan was the big case that started this in 1975, and there's two. Two guys I had in class at Notre Dame who were the attorneys in that case, Paul Armstrong and Jim Crowley, and they brought that case. Karen was, this was not a feeding tube case. She was on resuscitative things. She was, and she had all kinds of other apparatus, so the kind of thing you're talking about. And the family said, hey, let's remove all this stuff. And they did. They followed the proper things. They went to their pastor and they convinced, they made a good faith judgment that these are really extraordinary things. And the court held that she could, that they could remove that treatment, right? There was not food and water. But they could remove that treatment. Well, Karen lived for 10 years after that. And that was the case that started this. And pretty soon in New Jersey also, they lumped food and water in with medical treatment so that if the patient doesn't want food and water, then you can remove it. So that's where what you're dealing with there. And this is something you got to face, you got to deal with your own grandmother. Your grandma's in the hospital. What can we do? Do we have to feed her? Yeah. Well, yeah. There's three circumstances where you can remove a feeding tube. One is where it's excessively painful, which it almost never is, because that's pursuant to the double effect. You remove it not to kill the patient, but to relieve the pain. The second is where it doesn't, the body doesn't absorb it, which frequently happens, where the patient is not absorbing it. Yeah, you can remove it. And the third is in the closing minutes, hours, where it's not going to have any effect on death. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. Well, the conscience. Listen, let's get one thing straight. Conscience. How much time we got?
About 4 minutes.
Okay. Conscience is not simply your decision as to whatever I want to do. All right. Conscience is a judgment, and it can be right or it can be wrong. That German guy in the concentration camp. Sure, that was his conscience, and he followed his conscience, but he was wrong. He formed it incorrectly. All right. Now, when you're talking about Dr. Tiller, is it conceivable that he could have a clear conscience and do late-term abortions? Hey, this is mysterious. There's a mystery involved in this whole thing because it's a matter of grace. Joe Scheidler of the Pro-Life Action League has dozens of former abortion doctors and practitioners, And I've talked to these guys, and they say, yeah, Bernard Nathanson, I thought it was the right thing to do. You say, how could you possibly think that's the right thing to do? He did, all right? And yet, and it's not ours to judge that guy, but he's wrong, because your conscience can be wrong. Now, do you have the right to kill that guy? Would somebody have had the right in World War II to assassinate Hitler? Yes. Because you're talking there about the German law that put Hitler in power and kept him in power and ran the concentration camps was not valid law, period. And that was a war, right? Now, do you have the right as a private citizen today to kill abortionists? The question there is, are we in a state of justified rebellion? And that is a very difficult question. And a rebellion is a lot more difficult to justify than a war, because a war is conducted by the authority with responsibility for the common good, the state. Rebellion is a do-it-yourself operation. And the big problem with rebellion is that it causes more harm than good. And I don't think that's true. Paul Hill was the guy who killed the abortion doctor down in Florida. And we've talked with Paul Hill and talked to his family and all this. And when he was awaiting execution, his kids would ask his mother, "Where's daddy?" She said, "He's a prisoner of war." So his claim was that this was a war, right? I don't think that's a justified claim. But all right, one more, and then we got a break. Yeah. Right, you're right. Theoretical justification for killing would be that I am justified in a revolution taking for myself the authority of the state. The state has authority to punish crime even with death, but you don't, because you're a private citizen, unless it's a justified rebellion, which this is not. Anyway, listen, if you got questions on this stuff, let me know. I'll answer questions about everything except football tickets. Seriously, if you have questions on any of these things, drop me a line at Notre Dame Law School, Notre Dame, Indiana, 46556. Email Rice, small letters, rice.1@nd.edu. And I'll try to answer it. I'm high tech. High tech for me is a ballpoint pen, all right? But Rice, small letters, rice.1@nd.edu, right? Hey, you guys are great. This is really a neat group. And thanks. Okay, good.
Okay. Thank you, Professor Rice. Okay, guys, 10 minutes. Be back in 10 minutes, please. And by the way, you did a really great job of internal self-government.
Well, as you just heard, that was a very intense teaching situation. It was also an excellent teaching situation, as always with Dr. Charles Rice. I hope you learned something from that. If you did learn something from that, think about attending Camp American sometime. And you can find out more at www.campamerican.com. This is the next to last week that we're going to be running Camp American promotional classes. Next week, of course, we'll be at Camp American finishing up. And so we'll be running a program that is a class from a previous year. After that, we'll be doing our usual programs that are interviews, policy analysis, those kinds of things. So if you have any questions or comments, you can go to www.campamerican.com or go to www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. I would say we're out of time. Join us again on Monday for another Principles and Policies.